The Christmas story that we looked at in Matthew 2 was the arrival of the Magi. And they followed this shining star. And if we look at that, what we talked about last week, before Christmas, last Sunday, we could really say that these men, these Gentiles, were also just like these people in chapter 11. They were shining examples of men who literally walked by faith. They walked months across the desert by faith, believing that a celestial constellation and later perhaps even a divine guiding star was going to lead them to the King of Kings of the entire world. That had never happened before and was a greater king than all kings. And they believed that the heavens did declare the glory of God, and that there would be some kind of divine king, that they would go there, and they went there not to get anything, but to worship by faith, believing what the scriptures had taught, probably received through Daniel, through these magi. They believed what Hebrews 11:1 records, where we started a few weeks ago. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. They had the faith to believe what the Bible said over and above the scribes and the priests. And last time in chapter 11, we stopped at Abraham and Sarah. This morning, we're going to pick up at Abraham's son and the other great people of the faith. And I could easily and cheerfully go through each one of these verses and develop them, but I think we'll just kind of read them and kind of look at a couple of things, because there's so much here and we need to bring this all together about these men and women of faith. Verse 20 says, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. Verse 21, by faith Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each one of his sons, the sons of Joseph, and worshiping on top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the Exodus to the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones, meaning he believed that even though he spent his entire life in Egypt, and they had been hundreds of years, or he had been for a long time, and he knew somehow they would be hundreds of years there, that one day Israel as a nation would return. And by faith, he said, take my bones there. I want to be a part of it, literally. I want my bones to be there. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. They, by faith, feared Yahweh more than they did Pharaoh and what Pharaoh could do to them, which is a huge step of faith. Verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking for a reward. Interesting that he relates Moses to faith and the reproach of Christ greater than the riches of Egypt. Somehow, by faith, Moses understood that God was giving his people the promise of the coming of the greatest king that would ever come, what we celebrate at Christmas time. And he knew, even though with the culture and everything that was going on and the riches and the power that he had, and many Egyptians would have viewed Moses as a god himself. And he could have taken that role coming, because remember, he was drawn out of the Nile, and that's where they believed that their gods came from. And to be drawn out of the Nile equated you with divinity. But he didn't take any of that. He regarded all of that as a reproach, as nothing compared to the riches of his God and the promise of the coming Messiah. By faith, verse 27, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who was unseen. 28, by faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch him. Moses was the first one to believe that the blood of the lamb applied correctly would redeem someone or redeem their family from the curse of death. He exemplified the New Testament theology that you believe by faith that you're saved through the blood of the Lamb applied over the doorpost of your heart. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Verse 32, and what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by the resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mocking and scourgings, yes, and also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men whom the world was not worthy, wandering in the deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And all these, having gained approval through faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. You know, time does not allow us to get into all of these wonderful stories. As this author is saying too, even the writer of Hebrews had to cut it short because he realized there's so much to say. But the underlying current of all this was that they believed by faith that God was going to provide something for the world, and they believed that God was in charge of the world, even though they were experiencing so many difficulties, experiencing all of these persecutions and death and trials. And what they believed was that they would be a part of something much greater than the world had ever seen before. That, and the writer of Hebrews gives us the clue here, that they would be provided something better for us. So apart from us, they would not be made perfect. What he's really saying that is apart from us, meaning suggests that all those people who trust in God, living or dead, would be transformed together. There is a coming transformation when Jesus comes back for his church. And without getting into the all theological aspects of who goes up first and when and how it all culminates, the bottom line is we are all going to be made perfect. We are all going to be transformed, whether you are an Old Testament believer waiting in the promise of the Messiah or a New Testament believer trusting in Christ. And remember, these believers in Jerusalem were struggling back then with the ritualism, with going back under the law, not knowing, am I okay in purely believing by faith that Jesus is sufficient for my needs, to forgive me, which is the same thing that so many people struggle with today. Because we have so much traditionalism in the church, so much ritual in the church, and people always get drawn back into this issue of, do I need to do more? And this author is saying, no, look at the examples of the men and women of faith who by faith endured all these things. They didn't even know about the cross yet. And we on our side do. So now, as we get into chapter 12, this is where it all leads up to, what this author is leading up to. It all leads up to a therefore. We know in English, when it's there, we got to look what it's there for. It says, therefore, since we have such a great cloud of witness surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Let us run the race of endurance, the race that is set before us. And when I want to break down that a little bit as we look into this, this chapter in chapter 12 now turns to the practical side of our faith. What do we do with what we've learned over the past several months in all of these chapters in the book of Hebrews? James makes it quite clear. We know that faith without works is dead. Here's one of those places where Paul, if he's the author, is making the case that Christians have to do something with the knowledge of the truth that's been given to us. And so as we go on into these first two verses in this chapter, what we're going to be seeing is this author uses imagery of an athlete competing in a race, which is
logical
because Rome was very much involved with athletes. It's really where the whole Olympics came from, or at least became ingrained and established in Rome. And it may have started somewhere in Greece, but here in Rome, they really, really were into these athletes. And because they were often involved, the culture in the games and in running, they would understand the point that this author was trying to make about faith and running the race. And therefore, it's a really accurate analogy, I think, for us, because we all like to watch the Olympics and watch people run. So when he says, therefore, we have such a great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside and run the race of endurance, we need to get this in our minds. He's saying, we have people, witnesses around us that should cause us to now run. We see them and cause us to run. And we've been looking at these witnesses over the last few weeks. Abraham, Isaac, Sarah, Joseph, Moses, Rahab. Then go back further, we have Abel and Enoch and Noah. And then all these other ones that were mentioned just now, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets. And if you're like me, you can perhaps miss the real beauty of what this author is trying to say here. I used to think, as I would read these, that this was talking about this great cloud of witnesses that were superheroes. I watched part of Spider-Man last night with my daughter, the superhero thing, and I get a little overwhelmed with it, kind of shake my head on some of it. But the idea that we're surrounded with these superheroes of faith is kind of a cool idea. These men and women that walked in holiness, they never compromised. They had the faith of faith. They drew strength, and nobody could stand up against them. And I used to think, this is what it's all about, the chapter of faith. Yeah, I mean, what an amazing thing that we have men and women like that. And since we can see them, we should walk in strength as well. But believe it or not, I think that totally misses the point of what the author's saying. Some of the people that read this chapter, or read the chapter 11, think that the witnesses are on the sidelines and they're there to cheer us on. That they're saying, look, since we made it and we're the mega stars of the faith, we're just going to encourage you. You can do it. You can do it. Keep going. Look at us, look at how strong we are, and keep going. And again, I think it misses the point. A witness, this cloud of witnesses that we're looking at, a witness is defined as a person having knowledge of the truth, but willing to testify to that truth. That's a witness, testifying to the truth they know to be real and accurate. So it is not people witnessing us in our own race, or even referring to themselves, not even witnessing, we're not witnessing them as perfect believers. What I think it's all referring to is something much different. You see, those who are witnesses witnessed about the truth of God and the Messiah. That's what these people did. But they did it with the total sum of their life. And I want to define that, because what we have to realize is that many of them were huge failures. And they still testified to God and the coming of the Messiah through extreme times of doubt and temptation and persecution. All of the people we looked at in chapter 11, apart from Enoch and Abel, were very flawed people, just like me, maybe some of you. Jacob lived when he thought it would, lied, excuse me, not lived. Jacob lied when he thought it would benefit him, help him get what he wanted. Abraham abandoned his wife in Egypt, basically sold her for a few slaves and a few sheep. Noah got drunk, made a fool of himself. David was a murderer and an adulterer. Rahab was sexually immoral. Sarah was unbelieving and jealous of another woman who she sent away to die. And yet, God chose not to list any of their failures in that chapter. But he listed instead the times in their life when they did have those moments when they were willing to be able to walk by faith, have an assurance of the things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So I think a better way to view the chapter 11 in the first couple of verses here is that what chapter 12 is getting at is Since then, we have such a great number of people who are just like we are, men and women, who live their faith in the same temptations, the same challenges, face the same hardships with doubts about God, had marital problems, financial problems, struggles with pride, struggles with depression, struggles with self-worth. Since we have them as an examples, and yet they still live their lives for the Lord. They got back in the race because they used the total sum of their life to live for God and testify about Him. Then we should too. We should draw our strength as much from their failures as much as their victories, as much as seeing how flawed they were. That knowledge, that right knowledge of them, should be what gets us up back into the race if we've stumbled, because so much of the time people start off good in the race, and after something goes wrong and they stumble, they don't want to get back up. They don't think they can get up, or they should. I shared a few weeks ago how once I was depressed. I felt quite useless as a Christian. I felt there's no way God could ever use me. I was, you know, you just get into that position where you go, why try? And I'd been a Christian a long time, and I had never hit that wall per se before. But I hit it. I felt like I had sinned, and I would never be able to be accepted in God's presence again, until God brought me to Proverbs 24:16, which says, though a righteous man falls seven times, he rises again. And I understood from that verse where I was at that time in my life did not have to define me. Christ made me righteous before God by His blood. And I felt, in essence, that the same thing that this verse is saying. See, I had repented. I'd asked God for forgiveness, but I just didn't feel like it should go on. I didn't feel like it was worthy. You know, you always think I got to measure up to be somehow useful to God. And I went back and I read that verse. I was able to spend time thinking about it. And then I started rethinking Romans, rethinking Hebrews. And I even rethought a little bit about Romans 11, about the great men and women of faith. And the idea came to me, and it became so amazingly real, that if others in their lives had fallen and gotten back up and still became useful to God and then listed as men and women of faith, acceptable to Him, then I could too. And once I got back up on my feet, I think then I could start to understand what Paul, or the author, is saying here in this verse in chapter 12, where it continues to say, let us lay aside every encumbrance there, part of verse 1 there. Now, an encumbrance is not necessarily a sin. We know that because that it says, and every sin. I mean, don't lay aside every encumbrance and sin that can easily entangle you. So what's an encumbrance? Well, it's the little things that when you're running a race slow you down. I'm not a runner. Most of you guys know that. But I have noticed that when runners run, they run to win. And when they run and they train using water. I know it sounds weird, but they do. Why not drink Coke to train with? Tastes good. Get energy, right? When you drink a Coke, I get energy. Get that caffeine in you. It feels really good. Why not train with Coca-Cola? Because you can enjoy it, get a little energy, and run. It's legal. There's nothing, no rules against it. The reason that runners don't train with Coca-Cola is they found out real quick that their bodies cannot function at the peak performance that they need if they want to win, if they want to make it to the end of the race. That's why they use water. Okay, so if you wanted to, you could, and you could run any race drinking Coke. A long-distance runner could just drink as much Coke as he wants. But guess what's going to find out? In the middle of the race, it's going to slow you down. It doesn't hydrate your body. It may feel good. It may feel like it could hydrate your body, but it actually dries you out. It does the opposite, even while it feels like it's helping. There are things in our lives which themselves may not be wrong, but they slow you down. And in the middle of an endurance race, in the Christian race, they can dry you out. And the things you thought were going to make you strong or give you a little energy, they find out, they even taste sweet at the time. You find out, gosh, I feel no energy. I feel dry. I feel like I'm just hitting a wall in my life. What are some of those things? Again, these things in and of themselves don't have to be bad or sinful, but they're like Coke. Video games, watching a lot of television, sports on television, watching a lot of movies, doing a lot of these activities which are enjoyable, but you, when you use them and you consume them in great quantities, they can slow you down. How much time do you spend watching all of the football games or the movies here in Mexico, the novelas, the dramas, or video games, which is huge now, compared to your time worshiping, talking about the Lord, becoming a part of a church, serving in a church, doing a Bible study? We tend to think of those things as the little cream that will add on to our life rather than the core central, what makes us who we are. And we tend to think that those things are the things that we have the right to because we've worked hard all day and we want to do these other things. And what so often happens is those little distractions are eventually what lead to something that will take you out of the whole race altogether. A runner who's foolish enough to try drinking Coke and finding out later that it's slowing him down may turn to cocaine. Help speed him up. Now he's breaking the rules of the game. He's breaking the laws. He's becoming disqualified to run. You know, we could use steroids. You know, we could throw that in there too. So too the Christian life, sin will take you out of the race. You can get up to a point and go, yeah, I'm just not making it enough. And you can think you're strong enough to hang out with your old friends and go out New Year's, have a few beers. In and of themselves, again, you have to realize these things can entangle us. They don't necessarily cause us to sin initially. So the issue is you can do those things. You can go out to the bar. You can dance with your friends all night long with your unsaved friends if somehow you can keep drinking water, literally and spiritually, and not partake of the things that they are, that they think is so wonderful. If you think you're strong enough to go to sexually illicit movies, God bless you. I'm not. If you live with someone of the opposite sex you're not married to, and you think, well, it's okay, what's the big deal? I still go to church. All of these things, Paul says, can easily entangle you, and then they can bring you into this idea, this the other serious side of it, and it causes you to sin. So it's interesting how some translations of this verse says that the sin that so easily clings or sticks to us. I like that translation. If you've ever noticed, once you get hooked on something, whether it's drinking, drugs, pornography, anger, pride, even laziness, they end up clinging to you. You may not want it. You may want to get away from it, but every time you're trying to get away from it, it seems to stick to you. It's like running into one of Spider-Man's webs at full speed. You get stuck. You can't move. And the temptation is, I give up. I'm done. I can't go back to church now. Not after what I've done. And I'm stuck in this ungodly relationship. I'm addicted to this substance. I can't stop my video game addiction, which is now, you know, it's almost epidemic. I'm not in that world, but I've watched the statistics of the hundreds and hundreds of hours that people spend to the point where people die from starvation. Did you know that people die from starvation from playing video games? They will die because our dehydration, they will play so long, they wear diapers, they'll play for 3 to 4 days straight, nonstop, and they will collapse. And it's kidney failure, whatever it is. And of course, they're usually taking stimulants to keep going. So it's a combination of things, heart failure, different things. So you tend to give up, and you say, well, God's probably done with me, why bother? But the thing is, we learn from Hebrews, it's not true. You're experiencing the same thing David did, same thing Noah did, same thing Isaiah did. Each one of these men got to the point where they felt helpless, useless. Elijah coming, complete depression before God after one of his greatest spiritual victories, and thinking that he was alone and that no one was around to help him. He just went to go cry in a cave. But all of these men got unstuck, and they got up and they got back into the race. And the question is, how did they do it? And as we go into the new year, this is what I want us to focus on, because we are men and women of faith. And I think we need to be, if not doing this, sharing this. Depression is at an all-time high. Alcoholism, all-time high. Because of the isolation of COVID and all these things going on, you and I may not be personally that much connected to it. Maybe you are, but there are people all over the place that are feeling, why bother? I've just been stuck here, and the plan of the enemy has always been to separate the church, isolate us, depress us, and cause us to give up. We've got to tell people, no, there's all these other people out there, all of the men and women of faith, they went through this, they got back up and got back into the race. You can too. How can we do this? How can we know that we can do it? Well, really, the four reasons that I saw in this was number one, just a plain reason that we're in the race. The race is set before us, as the writer of Hebrews says. We're not spectators in the race. We're in the race. The moment you prayed to ask the Lord to come into your life to save you, you entered the race. And it's not a race against other Christians. That's unfortunate. People are always trying to compare themselves. You know, he's more spiritual than I am. I can't make it. He's so much better. No, it's the race that the Lord has set before you to get to the other side, to make it in the race with the Lord. It's not a race like running a race against the clock in one sense. You know, we're not racing against minutes and hours. We're measuring our race is in years. It's to be faithful to the end, to run to the end, to cross the line, which is your death, in faith. I still believe. I still love the Lord Jesus. I've not backed down. It doesn't matter my health. Doesn't matter the conditions in my life or what I'm going through. I trust in the Lord my God and my Savior. By the mere fact that God has placed me in this race, I continue to resist the enemy, which wants me to give up and stop running. So that's number one. The race is set before us. Number two, God has placed us in the race to win. Paul saw the life that he lived in the Lord as a type of race to be won. In 1 Corinthians 9:24, he said, "Do you not know that those who run in a race, all run, but only one receives the prize. Run in such a way that you may win." Obviously, it doesn't mean that we're running to gain merit salvation. What we win is our inheritance, Christ himself. What we win is the very fact that we are transformed, glorified, and we inherit the blessing of heaven, but also all that he wants to give us, the gifts that he wants to lay upon us. We're to run to win over Satan, over the world which wants to trip us up, depress us, get us down and give up. We want to win. Number three is we run this race of endurance. What we have to realize is our race is not short term. It's not a sprinting race. In the sprint race, the runner is decided in just a few seconds. If a runner falls, he has no time to catch up. I remember in middle school, I tried, you know, on track, I tried sprinting, I tried long distance. I am not a sprinter. I would lose so bad. But I found that I could run the long distance races. What's the difference? Endurance. endurance. Some people have spurts of energy, other people have endurance. Depends on how your body is made up and how you're trained. Our world today is like a 100-meter dash. Life seems to be what you can do right now. As you're young, you know, running full speed ahead, as fast as possible, get what you can. That's what our world likes to do. And, you know, today, in my own observation, I'm kind of neutral on a lot of this stuff, but I look at what the way people are transforming their bodies with tattooing and piercing and everything they're doing to their bodies, implants or what have you, because it's all about the sprint race. I want to look the way I want to look right now. I don't want to think about what I'm going to look in 40 years or 50 years. And you kind of went, okay, that's a sprinter for sure, because you might look a little funny in another 40 years for what you're doing to your body right now. But maybe not. Maybe that'll be everybody in 40, 50 years. We'll all have all kinds of interesting things on our bodies. I don't know. But what I have found is that the race of the Christian is an endurance race. And I thank God for that, because the endurance race, endurance comes from the Greek word hupomone, which means the capacity to continue to bear up under difficult circumstances. That's where the endurance runner comes in. He endures in the difficulty of exhaustion, of that length, of the time when his body is tired and worn out. The good news for the believer is, as we are long-distance runners, we can finish the race. You see, there's not enough time to get up when you're a sprinter. You can't make it to the end before somebody's going to beat you. You're not going to win the race. But a long-distance runner will tell you that you can get up and still win the race. Because there's an issue within every marathon race, I've heard, that you hit the wall. I did do this in middle school when I ran a little bit. But you hit the wall, they say. It's that place where the body says, I can't make it anymore. I can't make it. I'm not going to do it. I got to stop. And in that moment, the runners will all tell you, there's only one important thing that you have to do. The only way that you can win that race from that moment on is to do what? And this is point number four. Fix your eyes on the finish line. Fix your eyes and think of nothing else but that finish line. And when you do that, and you say, that's where I got to be, that's where I've got to go, then all of a sudden you can get that second wind and you can feel strong again, and so you can continue. That's endurance. And this is why the writer is using this analogy of running as a runner for the Lord. And then he says in verse 2, fixing your eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. So you can push through whatever has stumbled you or slowed you down and regain new strength if you fix your eyes on Jesus. And the word fixed here is only used one other time in the New Testament. And what it means is to look away from one thing to see another thing. I know it sounds simple, but that's the Greek mindset. You look away from one thing, your failures, your inability to go on, and you see another thing. And what is that you've seen? And you think about it without having one's attention distracted. That's the actual definition. See another thing with the keeping thinking about that without any distraction. This is what the author says. Fix your mind on him. Don't think about anything else. Don't be distracted by anything else. Well, you say, what exactly do I think about Jesus? How do I do this? Well, we all notice that he is the author and perfecter of our faith, is what the Hebrew writer says. This means that you're not the only one in the race of faith. Jesus is the one there with you, giving you the ability to believe in him, giving you the ability to see the finish line, that even though we're in this race with an invisible Lord and Savior, by faith, we can keep running it. We can keep going because he can be speaking to us as we're running. As we're running, we can be reading his word. And as we go into the new year, he can say, don't think about what your failures are. repent, be renewed unto me, get up and focus on me and start running the race again. See, he is there with you and he's telling you what to focus on. He's showing you how to. And this is why it's so wonderful, I believe, to come into the body of Christ, the church. Why it's wonderful to listen to worship and to sing songs that lift up your spirit, to listen to a teaching which then fixes your eyes on Jesus. Some of us wonder, why do I go to church? I mean, I used to wonder, I go to church and I come away, I feel better. I don't know, I remember everything the pastor said, but I somehow my spirit is lifted up. Well, because during that time, guess what? You're not distracted. You have fixed your eyes, your focus, without distraction, on the one area where Jesus says you need to keep it. And that's firmly on him. And right away, we have a few things given to us that should keep us thinking about our attention not being distracted. The writer of Hebrews here goes on to say, For who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. The first part of this last, and I think it's verse 2. How could Jesus find joy in knowing he was going to the cross? Francisco, will you check outside and make sure that bus is okay? If somebody's parked in front of him. How could we find joy in knowing he was going to the cross? Or how could he find joy in knowing that he was going to the cross? Well, I could suggest a couple of reasons. First of all, Jesus knew where he was going. He was going back to the Father. Good reason. As he hung on the cross, one of the two thieves asked him, Jesus, remember me when you go into your kingdom. And how did Jesus respond? He said, well, today you will be with me in paradise. He knew where he was going in just a few hours. Meaning, by the way, that he was not going to look forward to soul sleep for 1,000 years. He knew that that day, at that moment, he was going to be with the Lord in heaven. So that's one reason. Jesus is our finish line to bring us into that real paradise where there is set before us rest and peace and joy. There's joy set before us because of what is on the other side of the finish line. No matter what you're going through right now, if you fix your eyes on Jesus, joy does await you. And this is a good thing to share if you've gone through 2 years of just real isolation and real physical difficulty. And some of us have gone through some horrible stuff, including cancer, if nothing else. And he also knew that by him going to the cross, not despising the shame, we would not have to receive that shame on ourselves. I watched a movie with Renee a while back of this innocent girl. This nice young girl was kidnapped by some evil men. And her mother, with a private investigator, tracked down the kidnappers. Very suspenseful drama movie. And while there was, at the end of the movie, there was a shootout at the airport with these guys that were trying to take the girl away. But the mother sees a small jet getting ready to take off, so she tells her daughter to run for the plane and get on it to be safe. So the daughter makes a run for it, and as the daughter is making the run for it, she notices one of the guys coming around a corner with the gun and pointing it at her daughter. So what does the mom do? She sprints after the daughter, and she jumps in front of the gun right as he pulls the trigger. And of course, she's hit. And as she lays there dying, the private investigator then runs up to her and is holding her in his arms. And as she is dying, on her dying breath, she said, did she make it? Did she get away? Knowing that was the one thing that mattered to her. And of course, he tells her yes. And as he says yes, she smiles and she dies. Now, she died a tragic death, but she found joy in that death because she found that it saved the life of her daughter, the one person she loves. So my suggestion is that Jesus found joy in going to the cross because he realized that his death was going to save us, going to save you, going to save me from the bullet, from the death that we all face without him. And that brought him a great joy, knowing that by the shame of the cross, the death on the cross, and the suffering on the cross, we would live. And try thinking about that the next time you hit the wall in your faith. Think about that when you feel depressed and you think, what's the use? You say, well, wait a minute. I got to think about that he did that for me so I could get away, so that I could make it. That verse continues, and he sat down at the right hand of God, the right hand of the throne of God. Another reason why he endured the shame, because he knew that he was going to be magnified and sit down at the right hand of God. This brings us, by the way, full circle where we started in the book of Hebrews. In the book of Hebrews in chapter 1, verse 3 says that Jesus is the radiance of his glory, of God's glory, and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. That's what Jesus was going back to. Fully glorified, fully deity. Second person of the Trinity. When he had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. To sit at God's right hand, obviously, is a position of power and authority. And being at God's right hand, we can see how Jesus blends in with the Father as the second person of the Trinity. I love the fact that when you see Jesus with God, it's hard to distinguish Jesus from God, and I think that's on purpose. That's to show us his divine nature. He upholds the entire world simply by the word of his power. And the same mouth that called the world into existence and holds it together has called you into existence, and also can hold you together in this new year. It can hold you together by faith if you get up, fix your eyes on him, and keep running the race of endurance. And I think 2022 is going to be a race of endurance. With the restrictions coming upon the church, the ever unceasing mandates to try and keep believers from congregating and fellowshipping and legislating, all of these different things that tries to go against the word of God. It's going to be a race of endurance, but we can do it in joy. We can do it knowing